And I'm Kevin Fu. I'm from the University of Michigan, and I also direct the Archimedes Center for Medical Device Security. We have a great panel lined up for you today. It's largely going to be on the topic of medical device security, but we have a panel that's coming from three different perspectives. One from the industry of manufacturing medical devices, one from the perspective of having to use medical devices in actual clinical facilities, over 150 clinical facilities, in fact, and then also a government perspective from a regulatory body. So let me briefly introduce our speakers, and they'll tell you a little bit more about themselves. Before I do that, the format today is we're going to have very brief presentations varying from 0 to 15 minutes of slides, and then we're going to have a discussion. I have a large number of things I'd like the panel to discuss, but we will take questions from the audience. I do ask that when you ask a question, you approach the microphone, because we are recording this, and people who are watching the video really would like to hear your questions. So when you go to the mic, state your name, your affiliation, and then ask your question. So to my left is Ken Hoimy. He was formerly in the cardiac division of Boston Scientific as a fellow, and he's now at Adventium Labs. Lynette Sherrill is from the VA, the Field Security Office. And then we have Brian Fitzgerald from the Food and Drug Administration, who his bailiwick is primarily in the software arena. So without any further ado, we're going to have Ken get started to introduce us to some of the engineering challenges to medical device security, and then we'll begin our discussion.
Thanks, Kevin. So yes, as Kevin said, my name is Ken Hoimy. I just completed 11 and a half years at Boston Scientific, where I worked in remote patient management, all of the end-to-end security from our implantable device up through servers that have 300,000 patients worth of collected data, of weekly data uploads in that. I recently left and I joined a company called Adventium Labs, and probably nobody's heard of Adventium Labs, so this is the obligatory who Adventium is, but it's about a 30-person company. R&D, we do government research work, we do a lot of corporate consulting, kind of advanced stage research and development. So I'm joining there to focus on the medical device security space and see whether or not at Boston Scientific I was kind of limited to applying my solutions to our products and getting involved in working at national committee levels. But at Adventium, I hope to be able to go out and help solve practical problems in this space. As a caveat, having been recently at Boston Scientific, I'm going to talk about my perspective of what I think some of the challenges medical device manufacturers are facing, some of the things that medical device manufacturers should step up and do better. One should not presume that this all just represents Boston Scientific. I certainly have interacted with a lot more companies across my career, and I'm trying to represent this from an aggregate sense. So, in medical device security, people say, why is it that hospitals and medical device manufacturers can't figure the security thing out? Why are they seemingly in denial? And the petrochemical world seems to really get it right. And, you know, in having one of our AIME meetings and listening to people from the petrochemical world that we brought in talking about it, it became kind of one of these ahas to me, which is...
Oh, I'm sorry, Ken. AIME, you'll have to explain.
Oh, AIME. Oh, I suppose... That's true. Some of you here probably know who AIME is. Hillary does, who's our AIME representative. AIME is the American Association of Medical Instrumentation. It's kind of a consortium of device manufacturers, providers, government people, researchers. Has an education arm, but the basic one that Kevin and I are involved in, we are co-chairing a device security working group. It's part of the standards arm of AIME, so a lot of numbers that if you kick around in this world related to security and safety and software development standards all come out of various different AIME working groups. So that's what AIME is. Thank you, Kevin. We do get into our niches and throw our acronyms around without doing that, so feel free to stop me if I do it. So in the petrochemical world, there is a series of standards that have been developed called 62443, relatively extensive, about how to develop systems securely. And kind of the realization was is that in the petrochemical world, these people have been working for decades in a world where their physical assets are always at risk. They're having to invest money in physical protection of refineries, of tankers, of various different sites. They've experienced losses. So in some ways, there is a mind frame that people are trying to get at their assets, and how do I protect them? And the leap to a cybersecurity risk as opposed to a physical attack risk, I believe, wasn't a great leap, though I have had pointed out to me by people who were engaged in this process that it still took a long time to convince them that the risks were real. If you look at the medical culture within the hospital space, everyone within the hospital organization, whether it's the caregivers, whether it's the device manufacturers, whether it's the people that are putting the system, the clinical engineering department, it's all about saving lives. I mean, this is what people trained and what they do. This people spend these long hours and do this because they get satisfaction out of being able to help save lives when they're in there. There hasn't been a huge amount of physical security. I'd argue probably within a hospital context, the physical protection of the pharmacy because of the fear of theft of narcotics has been the area that there's probably been some of the highest physical security around those particular areas. What security things, and again, Lynette will be able to speak more directly to this, but my perception as a device manufacturer, it's been patient privacy and how to protect all the patient information that's within the hospital. And then the drive-by malware. It's the fact that devices are built on old versions of operating systems. Malware authors that have been generally going after a Windows platform with a particular vulnerability may catch a medical device. They're not writing it because their goal is to do something with the medical device, but that's been the bigger emphasis within the world. I think because of this perception that attackers are out for some personal gain, fame, access to narcotics, if it's physical, selling of information, that people fundamentally wouldn't want to hurt patients. And so I kind of coined this, used this term of faith-based security risk management, which is if you fundamentally don't believe that somebody would mount an attack because who would want to hurt them, then the likelihood of a particular risk is zero, and I don't have to mitigate it. Because people really wouldn't do that. And again, I think there tends to be a lot of tension amongst the security research community thinking that people are trying to deny this because they are out for profit motive and they don't want their sales impacted. My experience has been as people fundamentally, when you first start describing one of these risks to somebody and they say, why would anybody do that? It's like, well, you know, there are bad people out there. And so I think getting past this mindset that why would anybody do this is an acceptable risk mitigation. Is some, you know, an area that medical device companies need to get better at. It's just they have to understand it. And I'll talk a little bit later about, I think, the role of the regulators in helping people get their mindset in place. There's a lot of tension between security and usability and how to create systems that are very usable within the hospital setting. Clinical workflow is absolutely critically important. These people are really busy. They're being asked to enter more things electronically. There's a belief that all of this medical device integration will help lead to better patient outcomes. But if we put mechanisms in place that slow down the clinical workflow while improving security, that can be ultimately bad or bypassed by the customers. And at the same time, within the marketplace, competitors are competing with their own different value systems. So if you decide that security is paramount and you need to put something in place to enhance security and your competition goes by the previous faith-based mechanism that they don't have to do it, it might be a really simple thing but very insecure. Who makes the decision within the hospital system about which product gets purchased? Often the end user, the nurse, the physician that is actually using it, wants the simplest thing. Clinical engineering and IT may want the thing that allows them to implement a secure system, but again, we're within that competition. And within our space, my little quote here about our sales guy talking about somebody being able to remote program their ventilator off their smartphone. And I can't tell you how many times I was at some particular company and you'd hear something through marketing where it's like, oh, Medtronic is out there selling, you know, talking about this. How do we get that? And so it's this constant. And of course, marketing always hears it in the far extreme point of the world, and you're always having to try to filter what's really truth and how do you balance it. But that's kind of the environment that companies are in the middle of. medical devices are on really slow track development cycles. And hospitals own them for a very long time because of the time it takes to develop them, to get them cleared through regulatory bodies. You can easily get systems that are out there for 10, 15 plus years. That has impact both on the support cycle that manufacturers have to deal with. It also even gets to if a security patch is needed on a system that was fielded 12 years ago. By regulatory requirement, all the software tools and everything we need to test and validate that are stored and archived and are present, but they aren't necessarily going to be accessible. And who in the company still remembers how to pull out the compiler that we used in 2000 and be able to create this update? So there is this tension of, yes, you can, but the barrier to do that becomes very, very high. This is an issue that has been successfully faced in many other different domains, in the aviation world, in the industrial automation world. This is not a unique situation, but manufacturers need to really recognize that this is the life cycle, and I think hospitals in purchasing equipment need to make sure that the expectation of whether good choices have been made in that way are done appropriately. Developer skill sets, medical devices, these tend to be embedded real-time systems, and we start getting, I've heard many times that when we talk about security in medical device world, we immediately zoom in on how do we protect patient data and how do we encrypt patient data. But when you start talking about a medical device that's touching a patient and is doing a closed loop feedback cycle, it's safety. It's not really the primary thing is about the safety aspect of it. My sense is that people who come up with a pure IT security background tend to have less experience in real-time embedded systems, less experience in safety culture and how do you assess risk and how do you do that, and less experience in the constraints of living within a regulated device world and what is meant by the quality system and what are some of the things that get you into device space. On the other hand, people that come purely from a medical device world tend to not have experience about subtle behaviors of security protocols. And as I'm sure everybody in this room recognizes, the correctness and the security of an overall system is in the details. It's not just in the high-level stuff, so not necessarily have that background. And how to assess risk of future behavior of an adversary. Safety risk tends to be very data-driven. You collect data about history. Security tends to be about what are the future possible behaviors that somebody might be attracted or drawn to do. So you really need a cross-functional team and attract and retain those. There's a siren call toward COTS, and now I think the siren call is to the cloud. And it's that you can use all these commercial tool sets, you get all the programmers that really want to work in this particular space to work in it, and you jump on the bandwagon, and you get these inexpensive tool chains. But because of the previous mention, really, really long development cycles, sometimes you end up with the tools moving way faster than you are able to. You often have to do special validation requirements on the operating system, on the tools you use, which if you are not working with a vendor that's going to keep those and validate them as they move those versions up with you, you end up locked at this old version, and it's really expensive to move with the manufacturer of the COTS software. So there's a lot of hidden costs in a poor COTS decision. I want to touch a little bit on responsible security research. I'm sure everybody is here has heard all the various different stories about device being hacked and how it hits Wall Street Journal and all the things. And there's a real tension here, and I'm not going to provide an answer as much as we need to really think carefully in this space about how do we do this. If you really look at how many device hacks have led to harm in 2013, I don't know that we are aware of one that has actually happened in the wild. But we, from security researchers, you know that the threat keeps changing and evolving. And so the fact that there isn't any today doesn't mean 5 years from now there isn't going to be. And so pushing the market to improve is appropriate. But it's an ethical dilemma, which is how do you get device manufacturers with all these costs to move without creating so much fear that you're actually causing harm directly? And I have stats here from ICD use from my background, which is that typical studies have said about for every 11 defibrillators that are implanted, one life is saved. And I know we get phone calls after every one of these hacks that happen that would come into customers of patients calling in worried about their device. And my sense is, you know, if you had one patient in 1,000 decide not to have a defibrillator because of fear of whether or not it's going to get hacked, you'd have about 4 people per year dying of lack of therapy. Medical devices have clinical indications. They've gone through clinical studies. They actually have cost benefits that have been going to them. And so hacking and dealing with devices in this space is different than money spitting out of an ATM machine, which can be replaced by the bank. There has to be that ethical balance about how we do it. And I think we have to do it as a partnership in terms of how we work. So my final slide is we need to look at how we build bridges. I think from the regulator side of the world, regulators really help level the playing field. So one of the things that I was really thrilled about in seeing the draft cybersecurity guidance that came out is it starts changing of whether or not a device manufacturer can choose whether to add security or not. It's now everybody has to have some level of it. You're not trying to compete about whether or not somebody's going to just completely bypass it and whether you get any credit for securing your devices. Expect security risks are included in safety risk assessments. I think 80,001 for, again, the security academics here may not be familiar with, but 80,001 is an AMI development in conjunction with the international standards body related to how hospitals should build secure networks and how they should be able to manage risk management. Again, in this space, the hospital is a medical device integrator. They're purchasing devices from various companies, and then their IT and clinical engineering departments build it into a system. It's how do you build a system that's safe and secure. There's some issues with it, and I'm sure, Lynette, you could speak to the pros and cons of 80,001, but at least we need to get the hospitals demanding the manufacturers to produce devices that have the security in it. And I think we need to create, the regulators can create productive conduits between the researchers, hospitals, and manufacturers, create mechanisms to report things, et cetera. I think in the hospitals, it's developing expertise in both system security engineering, engaging the 80,001 standard, drive consistent, you know, put expectations on manufacturers to actually meet some particular standard of it and make that a requirement of the contract, and include security testing in the budgets. My recommended device manufacturer is that you got to get beyond this faith-based stuff. There are bad people out there. Security is a requirement. It has to be part of the design and development. They need to develop and retain security specialists and engage the standards groups to try to drive the consistent security requirements and help improve PAS amongst all the other different players. And I think from security researchers is learn about the regulated medical device. This is a different space. Reach out and partner with manufacturers, with hospitals, clinics. You know, meet with the physicians and nurses that actually use these devices. Understand the clinical use scenarios as part of their overall use environment. Figure out how to do mechanisms to communicate without what I refer to as conference ambush. Partner with regulators, manufacturers, hospitals, and tone down the hyperbole. Let's not use patient fear as the vehicle to do change. Let's use other mechanisms. That's my comments. You're going to do the switch over?
Okay.
You know where you put it?
Sure.
Thank you, Ken. Okay. So moving along, our next speaker is Lynette Sherrill from the Veterans Administration. And she'll be talking about medical device protection. And she can introduce her background a little more.
Hi, I'm Lynette Sherrill, and I'm the Deputy Director for the Health Information Security Division of, it's a really long title, so I'm going to try to shorten it for you guys. I'm in the Office of Information Security, which is part of the Office of Information Technology within the VA. So just to let you know kind of where all that sits. But so what my office does is we oversee medical device security for all 153 or 156 VA medical centers, depending on the latest count, across the nation, plus over 2,000 CBOCs. And what I'm going to try to do today is just give you sort of an overview of the landscape that we see and from the healthcare delivery organization perspective. And then the sort of religion discussions that Ken brought up, we'll save for the panel to discuss, because those are relevant and interesting all at the same time. So the landscape of VA's medical devices looks like this. It's a $5.5 billion in medical devices and over 600,000 discrete medical devices across all VA facilities. And obviously those range into every category. So we have extensive experience in monitoring and just managing these devices. We have an incredible expertise in this area in our clinical engineering staff. One of the things that might be interesting to you guys is most of these aren't network connected. So there's a lot of medical devices, there's not a lot of network connected medical devices. Our network connected medical devices make up probably less than 1% of this number. So in moving along in that, one of the things that we've done within VA is we had to define what a medical device was because, and we actually had this discussion before this even started. So in order to get education out to your field, we have approximately 450,000 clinicians in the VA in the hospital systems that we have to get education out to. So we had to define for them what is a medical device, what are we going to call a medical device. So within VA, we define a medical device, anything that's 510K certified, and then any of the supporting infrastructure that makes that device function, not including the network necessarily, because most devices will still function without the network, but you know, external storage space. Some medical devices are not necessarily medical devices, or medical device software is 510K certified, but the workstation that it runs on may not be. Go ahead.
510K.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're going to go to Brian for that acronym in a second. The FDA regulation is the, that's the certification that a medical device goes through by the FDA, and he can explain that process. I don't even want to try to, not with him sitting here. I would give it an attempt if he wasn't here, but so if the software is certified by the FDA. The workstation isn't necessarily, but obviously the software's not going to run without the workstation. So we encompass that workstation as part of that medical device, and we do monitor and we do treat it differently than we do other medical devices on or other IT-type devices on the network. One of the things that we've seen is, and everyone in this industry has seen, is medical devices have evolved over very quickly, actually, probably the past 10 years or so. We went from... I have an IT background, IT operations, then into IT security, which, oh, by the way, I think is the best way to go. You need to do operations before you do security. Just my little soapbox there. So one of the things, I kind of compare it to the mainframe guys in IT. Who in here is IT, first of all? Okay, you guys all know what I'm talking about then. So mainframe people, when the PC came around, all the mainframe people said, you know, oh, those things, they're not going to last. Mainframe's here forever. And that's just crazy technology. Go away from me with your crazy technology. I'm going to stick with the mainframe. It's a little bit like what happened in the medical device industry. Medical devices used to be in their own sandbox. They used to not touch the network. And all the clinical biomedical engineers used to be able to say, okay, all you crazy IT people, go away. Get away from me. And we still have biomeds and clinical engineers that do that. So... but they have evolved is the point. And just like we now have tablets instead of mainframes, you know, medical devices are evolving in almost as quickly of a fashion. There's significant research and development life cycles, but there's a lot of great advancements being made. The difference is these systems are so complex and they are becoming a system of systems. It's not, we've created this incredible biomedical device network across our entire nation that is very vulnerable to all kinds of stuff, but it's not something we can just run out and fix. We can't just run out and patch it or throw a bunch of security stuff at it without, as Ken pointed out, breaking some functionality that we really need in those devices. And we're going to talk about what VA has done, because I don't think what we've done is, it's definitely not perfect, and it has some huge sustainment costs that go along with what we've done, but we did what we had to do to maintain patient safety, which is at the end of the day what we're all trying to do. So moving on, a couple of other things. I already kind of talked through this slide that medical devices are different. You can't manage a medical device just because it looks like an IT device. It connects to your network like an IT device. It talks like an IT device on your network. Doesn't necessarily make it an IT device. So you can't just start pushing software and patches and things to it because there could be a patient hooked up to it. And what if that reboot, that forces that reboot while your patient's hooked up to it? That would obviously be a bad thing. So we try to stay away from those things. We try to be very sensitive. One of the things that we're working with in this space is something I like to call a shared risk responsibility between the healthcare delivery organization and the manufacturer throughout the life cycle of this device. There is a shared risk responsibility. As the HDO, your hands are tied from doing patching and loading stuff on that could impact the safety and functionality of the device. From the manufacturer standpoint, they have no control over your network or what you introduce to that medical device. So you can see where there's a natural tension that's going to exist between those two, as long as there's that shared risk responsibility. And I think it has to be there just by the nature of the devices, but we have to figure out a way to work it. So moving on, the VA's Medical Device Protection Program is a collaborative program that we set up where my office oversees and provides guidance and monitoring of the program in collaboration with what VA calls their healthcare technology management arm, which is the clinical engineers / biomedical engineers of the field. I think they're all still trying to figure out what their official name is going to be in the wild. And I know Amy is working that issue with them. So what we really had to set up a collaboration because this is not an all IT security issue. It's not an all clinical engineering issue, and it's not an all IT operations issue. You really have to get all of the entities involved that are involved with the maintenance of this device. Trying to see what I did. This is the tracking of VA's medical device infections. It's a little weird that I placed it right here, and I'll not share my story with you. I will, really. So here's my technical buyout for the moment. I switched laptops this weekend, which is why Kevin didn't get these slides, and I had to do all this stuff on a new laptop, so that's my out right there. So I don't know why. So my slides might be a little off here. But anyway, VA has tracked about 359 medical device infections since January of 2009. We started tracking medical device infections when I was the head of the computer network defense team at the Security Operations Center. We began to notice that these devices that didn't meet our standard naming convention were passing very odd traffic out our gateways across the network. We were doing some traffic analysis, and we're like, what is that device? Well, and then we found out, oh, wow, that's a PAC system. Wow, that could be kind of bad. Why is it doing that? So we started really, like, maybe we should start tracking that. So we did, and we found out that we had medical devices infected, and it was kind of like, what do we do about that? And we called the manufacturer, and like, well, what do you mean you have medical devices that are infected? And so then the conversation begins, right? They don't know. They're like, and really the industry has such a broad scope of answers. Some medical device manufacturers, and I'm going to clarify here for a moment, I'm talking about network-connected medical devices. I have no expertise in implantables other than, you know, what I've seen Kevin publish, but that's it. So we really had to figure out how do we do this, because the first thing you do is you see something infected on your network as an IT person, you pull it out of service, you put a new one in service, you're done. Well, you can't do that with a medical device. Like, what do? You have to determine if there's a patient hooked up to it. Is it in the middle of a procedure? How do you gracefully pull it out of service? And then you call the manufacturer. You get everything from, okay, we'll help you respond to this, to, oh, it's no big deal. Just keep using it. It's good. So there's a broad range of knowledge in this area. So we really felt like, okay, we need to start tracking this because we need to know for ourselves what's going on in this space. Some of the other things, I'll get through this real quickly. Some of the things we have done internally that have helped to make a difference, we have a pre-procurement assessment process where we do ask the manufacturer, in addition to the MDS squared form, we ask them to provide additional security answers to security questions about the profile of their device so that we understand what it looks like coming on our network. That has been interesting as well, because some manufacturers at the sales side don't necessarily know. They'll say, oh, well, this is my favorite answer. And I am picking on manufacturers. So I'll say I'm not. But some of them are like, oh, well, your ports and protocols. Well, that's proprietary. We can't tell you that. I'm like, I'm going to find it out. So you can tell me when you put it on my network, I'm going to find it out. So, you get a broad range of answers with that. But we do ask for that. We made it part of our procurement lifecycle. We actually are in the middle of a revision with this. We're actually making it more stringent. We're asking a lot more questions in this space. Probably the biggest press we got was the design and implementation of the medical device isolation architecture. Because of the threat that we're experiencing, it was a firestorm of infections that was happening in 2009. And I think it was more we were just looking for it. And I think that's a question we have to ask ourselves as well. Are we looking for it? You know, because it's very easy to be in this space and say, oh, we haven't had any adverse events toward patients. But if we're not looking for it, are we ever going to find it? So that's like just something to throw out there. But when we found out we had a problem, VA's leadership was very, very concerned. And we immediately put in every medical device in the VA is now behind an isolation architecture. For those of you with the IT background, that is a VLAN. All the medical devices are isolated behind VLANs with ACLs. It is a highly cost. There's a high cost of sustainment and a high cost of implementation of this type. And we have continuous monitoring efforts that go on to make sure those VLANs stay in place. But as you know, the first thing you do in troubleshooting any type of network problem with a medical device when it's behind isolation architecture is you drop the VLAN, drop the ACL, so that you can see what's going on. So it's not a great answer, but it has helped somewhat. But it's also made us blind. So there's pros and cons to this, right? We've seen somewhat of a decline, but when we do get an infection, we see a large infection because usually it's the virus is contained within the VLAN, so then it just infects everything in the VLAN. So there's some pros and cons with that whole thing, and you know, if you guys are interested, I can talk more about it later. Implementation, we did an internal patching server. So for those devices where we receive permission from the manufacturers to patch, we have a separate patching server just for medical devices that is internal to the VA, and it's very tightly monitored and secured, very little access to anyone, and we open up the ACL from the medical device only directly to that patching server. And it also, that same server hosts the DAP files for antivirus for those devices that can run antivirus. We also set up a fairly extensive medical device incident reporting infrastructure. So when a facility suspects that they have an infected medical device, they do proper notification to our SOC. And then that automatically alerts my team as well as the National Biomedical Engineering team. And we get together and we respond jointly to the incident. We get the facility on the phone and we get the specifics of the incident. And then we really manage that incident nationally and track it nationally through complete remediation, which in the VA, complete remediation is the device has to be taken out of service and be reimaged and taken out of patient care as soon as safely possible to do so. And that's why we have to have the engineers involved, biomedical engineering. And we do. We call the manufacturers as well because we can't just pull the device out. I mean, the engineer has to make that call. They have to evaluate. They know that device better than I do as a security person. So they help us make that call. We tell them the threat. We tell them what that virus does, how it acts, what the issues are with it. And then they know that device. And then we talk to the manufacturer. And we all jointly sort of make that decision. One of the big things that we found has been incredibly successful is the education and communication. We regularly, I'm talking quarterly, have at least 4 webinars on medical device security for the whole VA. We invite clinicians, we invite biomedical engineering staff, we invite IT staff, because IT staff don't know medical devices any more than biomed know IT devices. I mean, it's just, as Ken pointed out, you have people that know IT, people that know medical devices, but trying to get them to converge on this issue. So we host lots of education. We participate in forums like this to help get the information out and get people talking about this, because again, if we don't know and we don't talk about it, we're never going to find solutions to this incredibly complex issue. Some of the other things that we're doing in, within the VAs too is we're partnering with people like Amy, but specifically we helped found a nonprofit consortium as a public-private partnership between with VA and Kaiser founded it together so that we could start addressing specifically these issues and start talking about it. We get manufacturers and healthcare delivery organizations together, and we're having some really great discussions around this space. How do we, from a manufacturer standpoint, they're trying to understand the healthcare delivery organization's position and the business that the infrastructure that we're running these devices in, to the healthcare delivery organization understanding the development life cycles of the manufacturer, because we have to do this jointly. We can't, I think Ken made a great point, we can't let the hyperbole of the latest press release, you know, drive the solution in this. And we have to really come up with real evidence, real facts that we can deal with. So, because at the end of the day, we got to manage the risk in this area. We can't go all one way or another. It's about the individual devices. And it really, that even brings to the complexity of the issue is every device is different. It's like in VA, we have this saying, it's called One VA. And, you know, that was what, it was a big marketing campaign for the VA. So like, if you go into One VA as a patient, you've every VA should treat you exactly the same, but internally it's like one VA is one VA because everyone is totally different. And it's very hard. And any of you that work for large corporations know it's extremely difficult to have every single place act the same, extremely difficult for every medical device that's deployed to be deployed exactly the same way with exactly the same version of software and things like that. So it's, again, a complex issue. I think we've made incredible strides since Brian and I first met, like 4 years ago now. And we've made incredible strides, and really it's been through talking with people like you guys are that are interested in this space and want to help contribute to it. So we really appreciate you guys coming. And that, I'm going to close it up and turn back over to Kevin. Oh, wait. Yeah, I missed all kinds of slides. Sorry.
Okay, thank you, Lynette. Our next panelist is Brian Fitzgerald. He's the deputy director for, let me see if I get this right, because your organization is also as deep as the VA. Division of Electrical and Software Engineering in the Office of Science and Engineering Laboratories within the Center for Devices and Radiological Health within the Food and Drug Administration.
Within HHS.
Take one. Okay. Let me pull up. Okay. So I think Brian is mostly going to speak. Here is your slide.
Thank you, Kevin. So, 510K. Section 510K of the Food and Drugs Cosmetics Act talks about a class of, or several classes of devices which only need to be substantially equivalent to a pre-existing device or to a pre-medical device amendments device to be placed on the market. We have a relatively short space of time to review those, and they're not called applications or approvals, they're called clearances. So while that clock is ticking, we get an opportunity to look at the technologies. We get an opportunity to look at 510K devices from a wide variety of perspectives. Engineering analysis, of course, when it comes to software, electrical engineering, and cybersecurity would be the, I guess, the principal ones. But the problem is that that's not a lot of ticks on that clock when you have to do all of the other parts. So as devices become more and more complex, more and more interconnected, so our regulatory processes have to become more and more agile and adroit at getting them on the market and getting the American public the safest medical devices possible to have in the shortest possible time. Well, that's cramming more and more stuff into those same clock ticks. So one way that we do that is to try and set the bar out plainly and openly what we expect of manufacturers who are going through this 510K process. I must say that there's another process called a PMA process, which is another part of the law, which deals primarily with devices that are new and where the risks are not yet fully understood or by both sides of this, by us and by the manufacturers. And that requires a much higher, much longer process with usual clinical data acquisition. But many of those devices have the same review activity when it comes to their engineering aspects. So I'll concentrate on the 510K because that's probably, in any given year, that's probably 90, 95% of the devices that we see. There's another class of devices that we don't see because they're not subject to clearance under the 510K or approval under PMA. And many of those have, yes, the same engineering and the same cybersecurity vulnerability. So a good chunk of the devices that are on the market are actually exempt from FDA review. But they have the same IT-related engineering constellation that surrounds them. Why is this? Well, it's because FDA was founded in order to look at risks with respect to the patient. And let's say that unintentional harm from a safety perspective was always the thing that we looked for. Now, safety and effectiveness is the bar, and because of the 510K being substantially equivalent, we look at as safe and as effective as the predicate device that that it's being compared to. So we have this this regulatory structure that was set up in 1976. It's been built upon over the years. About every 10 years, we have the Congress bless us with new requirements and new things that we have to do. And for that, we're eternally grateful. But those clocks are the same length. There's only so many ticks in that clock. And what we have to do is work to find ways of ensuring that we do a sufficiently rigorous review in those ticks. Well, we lay out those requirements, and for the 510K, and PMA, we have guidance documents. Guidance documents are what they sound like. They're guidance. It's not a regulation. It's guidance. It's guidance on what we expect the common understanding, the common semantic framework of where our expectations in FDA lie, so manufacturers can use engineering and all the economies that come with sound engineering to make a device that's going to sail through the clearance process as soon as possible. But as I said, it used to be that we were looking at unintentional harm, failures of equipment that led to safety. Now, it's both intentional and unintentional. And what that means is that the review of our post-market activities, when we review a device that comes in with a problem related to, I think, having hurt a patient or something, used to be that we could look at this from that unintentional perspective, where the safety and effectiveness could be reviewed, and all it would take would be a panel of knowledgeable biomedical engineers and then physicians to make a decision as to what to do about this device. Now that review has to begin to turn around whether the intentional vulnerabilities have now become threats to both the device, the patient, and other devices on the network. A whole new way of thinking. And it's that whole new way of thinking that has, over the last, I'd say, 5 to 7 years, manifested itself in the way that we are doing business. We just recently, and my slide here, points some communications that we've put out. These are clickable links, at least they were when I sent them to Kevin anyway. So these clickable links would take you to our safety communication about some events that have happened recently. Security research is bringing to our attention some very interesting deficiencies with respect to devices that have been fielded. Many of those devices, however, were just not sold on the US market. Other devices have the vulnerability, but it doesn't seem to manifest itself as a threat, at least in the use environment that it's being used in. And some, yeah, they really do have vulnerabilities listed there which are threats. So they're being dealt with. But this gave us an opportunity to put out one of those guidance documents that I just mentioned, which for the first time talks about what we expect in the pre-market from manufacturers with regard to what the designs need to look like, what they need to contain. If you'll think for a moment, however, because it takes us generally quite a few years to get a document, a guidance document out the door, what with different reviews and aspects of editorializing, etc., ensuring that it meets appropriate policy objectives, we struggle to be very specific in these guidance documents. If we were too specific, the technology would overtake the recommendations or the guidance statements that we make in these. So we try to stand back and think of abstractions here. And I guess at one point you really have to appreciate that abstractions can keep a document relevant a little longer. Well, the second one, the cybersecurity of a medical device, goes back to 2005. That was published in 2005, and it really is not about cybersecurity. Unfortunately, it's about patch management. And patch management is something that the VA and FDA dealt with way back in the day. Even before I met Lynette here, the HISD division out there in West Virginia was working with FDA to find ways to ensure that patch management was being done appropriately. So understand this, that a medical device manufacturer, when they place something on the market, continues to remain responsible for it for the lifetime of that device. No matter how long it's out there, they still have responsibility for ensuring that device meets the level of safety and effectiveness for which it was either cleared or approved. Okay, what that does is it causes the way in which they're regulated to bump up against the need for the IT folks to do patching irrespective of who actually sold that device to them. So early on, VA and I confronted this this serious mismatch, because you could easily end up with situations where a medical device manufacturer says, you cannot patch my device because I don't know what you're doing to it. If I'm going to be held legally responsible for this, you can't touch it. I will touch it. I will validate it. I will make that patch after I've done that validation. That's frequently not fast enough to mitigate the potential threat. So some secondary mechanism had to be invented. And I have to tell you that back in 2006 and 2007, very complex webs of VLANs were very, very not just expensive, but they require, you know, large amounts of human resources in order to maintain them. But that was the secondary mitigation that VA came up with in order to manage the necessary legal delay that manufacturers have when it comes to them validating that a particular patch, some arbitrary patch, either doesn't affect their device at all, so just don't put it on, or B, it does affect the device and it might cause this particular problem for which I'm responsible. So we've evolved in the way that our regulatory stance interacts with the clinical care community, the healthcare delivery organizations. And one part of that was to develop some standards. And I want to point now to the last line there, standards recognition. Last week, we recognized some standards that a manufacturer now can use for their clearance and approval processes when it comes to cybersecurity, 6443, the 80001 suite, We point now directly in our standards part of our web page, so that manufacturers can now use standards, and we will give them credit at those review points for having complied with those standards. Now, it's axiomatic that the embedded nature of these medical devices, and many of them, most the huge majority of embedded systems, they really do fall along SCADA systems and industrial control systems guidelines. I mean, they're really just those types of systems used with a marginally different risk management paradigm. So while Ken and Kevin are co-chairing the AMI committee, we fully expect that that AMI committee will come up with medical device tailored versions, if that's necessary, of the 62433 family of standards, taking the well-known aspects of that standard and translating them with the new risk management paradigm for medical devices, if that's necessary. If that's a kind of a big, long review process, and it might end up with a medical device version of that. We also, for I guess since 2005, we've been working with clinical care communities, the manufacturers, et cetera, to work on the 80,001 series of standards, which is about incorporating medical devices onto IT networks. It tries to address the cultural difference between medical device manufacturers who need to continue to be held responsible for the performance of their device with the culture of IT network administration, so that we saw that this was going to be something that was coming up in the future, and so we pressed ahead, and this family of standards is now an international family of standards. Of course, understand also that FDA does not regulate the clinical care community. We have only one big stick, and that's on the medical device manufacturers. The clinical care community, VA is one of those, even if it is a very, very big one. The clinical care community has to find also the resources in order to protect its networks and its medical devices on its networks from these threats. And these are lean times. It's increasingly difficult for IT people to justify why they need all these intrusion protection systems and et cetera. At a place like the VA, it becomes possible to do that, but at small, regional, perhaps even provincial, county-level clinical care environments, this is a bridge that's too far. The traditional, advanced, relatively modern intrusion protection and prevention systems are just not there. And as we roll out health information technology down to the patient level with the ubiquitous nature of electronic health records, I see this as emerging as a future problem. How do we protect micro networks from these types of threats, other than by having a very good pre-market review cycle and some kind of availability of IT expertise at a micro network, micro business sort of level? Most of your physicians, as you'll probably almost certainly be aware, work in small practices where they have a small network, and they may have little expertise in cybersecurity prevention. They may only have basic IT provision there. So with that, that's sort of a 15-minute blast of FDA regulation. But with that, let's see if we can have a little discussion. Kevin, over to you.
Okay, well, I hope that gave you at least an introduction to this problem space and where we're going to go now with the discussion. And feel free to run up to the mic, but we're going to get the discussion going right now. So what wasn't yet mentioned, in great detail, was that FDA has released what's called a draft cybersecurity document. I've forgotten the exact title, but it outlines sort of the expectations for what I would consider sort of good cybersecurity hygiene. And what I'm curious about from our panelists, I guess Brian wouldn't have to comment here, but your reaction to this draft guidance and its potential effectiveness at improving the situations that you see in your jobs, and where maybe what are the big problems that would still likely remain? We could start with Ken and discuss.
Sure.
And you can tell us a bit about your interpretation of this draft guidance.
So, my interpretation of the draft guidance, and again, I think what Brian was just mentioning is this limited to PMA applications at this point, or is it also something you're going to expect for 510K? Okay, so from my perspective, this does what I was referring to as potentially levels the playing field. So my interpretation of what the cybersecurity guidance is it basically asks manufacturers to consider cybersecurity risks in their overall quality system in their risk assessment and deliver as part of their documentation a table that cross-checks the various different risks, how they've chosen to mitigate them or not, and the rationale for it, so that essentially it's forcing manufacturers to acknowledge that this is a class of risks that's present and how they dealt with it. And if a manufacturer has used the faith-based approach that this can't happen and the likelihood is zero, then the mitigation table would be blank, and I would assume that wouldn't be viewed as necessarily a well thought through position by the regulatory body. So I think in terms of pushing things forward, obviously there's no absolute. FDA always asks manufacturer to use a risk management process established by senior management of that company about what the risk acceptability levels are. So there's not an absolute standard saying you have to be here or there and we'll approve you or not, but it forces the organizations to have internal plans for it and have a dialogue with the FDA about what they've done about it, and it ratchets things up, which I think is a good thing.
And let me translate a little bit to the security research community. So when Ken is talking about quality systems, to translate it into the research field, I would call that sort of the design security in as to opposed to bolting it on. So this guidance is much more about designing security in early on. And another comment is about very rarely do we have a research paper, USENIX Security, or other conferences that talk about the benefits of not securing a device. and the strange thing is there are potentially benefits to doing no action in certain cases, if there's a great benefit to the patient. That's something that would need to be taken into account for the risk management equation of sorts. Right?
Yes, I mean, certainly, and I think the example of that one is if you introduce something that really delays therapy in an emergency situation, you actually might introduce situations where more patients would be harmed. And so devices, as Brian was saying, they're safe and effective. And if you improve safety but reduce efficacy, you may not, in the end, have done net benefit to the population.
So I'd like to leverage off that one and point out that it's not merely in order to prevent delays or denial of service. Many technologies that are employed, real-time technologies that are employed in particular body area networks, they can consume quite a lot of power. And when something has been implanted within your body, it's a Mars shot for us. It's there until it needs to come out. And if it comes out too soon because it's used up too much power, that's a grave danger for people who are already very sick, having to undergo further anesthesia in order to explant and replace the battery. So the limits of technologies that we see coming into the medical device arena have to be all traded off, one against the other, for the benefit of the patient, and not necessarily for the benefit only of the security. And that's why I mentioned this risk management paradigm that needs to mediate the 62433 approach. And I think in the course of our AIME activities, we may very well find that we do have to slightly mediate that we haven't got that far yet, but we may find that we need to mediate it in a way that allows us to have the risk benefit pushed more towards the patient's benefit rather than the information risk.
All right, so and we're going to move on to Lynette before we take a question. So I don't know if you've seen the guidance document, but if not, here's a great time for Brian to do his education. but I'm curious, what's your perspective at the VA on how that might help in helping your patients or where you still see some areas that will need improvement?
I think that the guidance from the FDA is always kind of good for us because it gives us something to point to at procurement with the manufacturers, right? Always looking for a way to say, hey, we really would like to see you, you know, take a look at this. I think it's good. I think it does help those devices we're buying, right? But it goes back to what Ken said. We have devices we already have in place today. Doesn't really help those. I think it helps down the road, which is all we can really hope to do. There's sort of two-phased approach in addressing this issue. One is the devices we have in play today, and those are, we've got to figure out how to mitigate the risk around them. The ones coming into Brian's space and then into the market, we have to build security into those, and you have to start somewhere. So I think that that's an incredible step. I think, though, that once those get into market, because of the technology that's being used is incredible technology, the threats to it are going to continuously change. So I guess where I see that it doesn't address is the long term. You know, where how do we continue to address it after it gets onto the networks? How do we continue to address that maintenance cycle as that device has that 15-year life cycle? You know,
15 years? Okay.
At least, something like that.
And I think the average software life cycle is what?
3, probably, okay. Right? Maybe, unless, you know, I guess iPads now, like what, 6 months? They come out every 6 months.
So
you don't
have 6 months. Okay, so we have, feel free to ask questions. When you come up to the mic, please state your name and affiliation, and go ahead.
Hi. Adrian Gropper, patient privacy rights. Are we close to the end of the manufacturer-based regulation methodology that underlies the 510K and everything else that's going on here? I've seen this in issues around connecting devices in ICUs, for example, where life-critical devices have to communicate with each other, and the safety and effectiveness of what's going on is very hard to regulate unless they come from a single vendor, which is becoming more and more difficult in the very networked environment we are. And the analogy I would ask about is what we do with cranes at a work site, at a construction site. We're not regulating the crane manufacturer. We are auditing or penetration testing, if you would, the installation in that particular environment as a regulatory mechanism.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Principles of system engineering show us that merely because we secure all the individual components doesn't mean that the system would be secure. What we really are confronting, and I think this is one of the challenges for the 21st century, is the need for system interoperability and system cybersecurity, which is one is the evil twin of the other. Remember that. For them to have a system integration capability at the point of use. This is a non-traditional skill in healthcare delivery environments. And I don't know where we're going to get it. As complexity increases, so the risks between the cracks of the pieces tend to emerge. And new types of risks may emerge that we can't imagine at this moment, which really will only be addressed by astute system integration.
Just a brief add on that one. Before I was in the medical industry, I was in the aviation industry and worked a lot with Boeing and Airbus. And there's lots of analogies. You know, the industrial automation even really has a similar analogy. In those systems, there are large-scale system integrators. I mean, Boeing was a system integrator, and their reputation and the survival of their company depended on them working through all these issues with their suppliers. People make a lot of analogies, but the observation I've made is the healthcare system is more like the Oshkosh crowd. It's the Experimental Aircraft Association. I mean, Kaiser and VA are huge, and they have staffs that can handle it, but all those community hospitals really don't have the skill set about necessarily how to do all that. So trying to solve this systemically in a way that, because there really is system integration and system engineering skills that aren't necessarily at these hospitals, and so that's, I think, a challenge of how to build that.
All right, Mike, you have a question?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. name and affiliation.
Mike Amati, Codenomicon. So, Brian, this is directed at you, obviously. So, two things happened recently that have been raised a lot of interest, at least with some people. One is, of course, the release of the draft guidance document, and then quickly after that was the solicitation from the Fed Biz Ops for the Codenomicon DefenseX tool set, as well as the announcement that the FDA is building a cybersecurity testing lab. So I've had an onslaught of questions from both reporters, device manufacturers, and they say, what is the FDA doing here? Why are they building a test lab? What are they going to be doing? Why fuzzing? And I said to many people, well, I could tell you why, because we're great, but maybe you should ask the FDA, you know, what their thoughts are. I mean, why are you building a cybersecurity test lab, and why have you chosen fuzzing as a sort of a starting point?
So in Center for Devices, we have a lab function, the Office of Science and Engineering Labs, and what we do is we work at both a forensic level, investigating device failures, but also at a test method development level, working with standards publishers in order to develop criteria for why a particular set of tests would be sufficient and necessary to reveal an inherent goodness of some aspect of a device. So all of these, in this elaborate world of complexity that is emerging, point towards the fact that we're seeing devices come in now which will interoperate with other devices that are not on the table, if you like, at the same time. That these devices are themselves systems that have been composed and integrated with a system integrator, but they're intended to move into a healthcare facility where they will be integrated by who knows who, onto an IT network, and those devices are intended to work together. Or it could be that they're intended to work in a body area network with other devices as well. Well, we have remarkably good, I think, insight into the testing tools from the bottom up. Our software static analysis and dynamic analysis tools in our lab have helped us understand for probably seven or eight years now, how to look at failures of devices, what are the vulnerabilities that we need to bear down upon, etc. But very few of these tools are system-level tools. Fuzzing actually is a system-level tool. And one aspect of fuzz testing is that you can run it on whatever the current end-of-line unit is that is just about to go into its box and be shipped out. And you can run it on the image of that device that you may have published a couple of years ago. As these tools get updated with new scripts, new capabilities, new transmission vectors, you can look at devices that you may have fielded not just today, but last year and 4 or 5 years ago. As engineers and as regulators, it's incumbent on us to understand the capabilities of these devices, not the least of which may be that we at some point need to determine why a particular vulnerability turned into a threat and then turned into an exploit and then turned into harm. So this is a natural extension of what we've been doing for a long time. Why the Codenomicon tools? Well, they have a remarkably good reporting capability, which is a very important aspect of this. And why only Codenomicon tools? It's because we don't have a lot of money this year. So you may have heard about that. When we did this for static analysis, we looked at a wide variety of different static analyses, and we always did this in the context of the NIST SAM8 process, which a NIST of a process for looking at these advanced software testing tools of one form and other, system testing tools, and we would just, you know, as the money came available, we would get another tool and add it to our collection, and internally we'll look at one versus the other. This gives us an insight as to what these tools are good at, and frequently we find that tools are very, you know, from one manufacturer are very good at one aspect, and another tool from a different manufacturer might be very good at another aspect. And that's really why.
Okay. All right, I see we have another question. Of course, if you have any disagreement with what the panel says, you can also come up here too. But, next question.
I'm Dennis Wikun, University of Michigan. So the question is for Brian and maybe a little Ken. We talked about the parallels between the medical device industry and the process control industry. I heard mention of IEC 62443, which came out of IEC 99. And the question here is, how similar are the models between the process control and the medical device industry? Because I can see many differences. For example, like an oil tank doesn't walk around or go to Japan. So the threat models could be very different. Although, don't get me wrong, I think leveraging a lot of the work from the process control industry is a very good idea. But how far can we use the analogy?
Great question. When you're starting at the bottom, you've got to take what's available. And I'm an engineer, and I don't invent anything. I steal it where I can. So, for the next few years, we have to acknowledge the fact that industrial control systems, SCADA systems, have about a five-year, maybe a little more, advantage on medical devices. When you consider the way in which complex medical devices are actually composed of other subsystems that themselves are SCADA systems, that integration leads us to pointing to this particular standard, its family of standards actually, as a way for manufacturers to understand what they may want to call out in their purchasing. Now, the components of a medical device under the law themselves are medical devices. Fine. But real businesses have to make real devices, and they have to specify real requirements for what goes into them. And it's often very helpful when a manufacturer is making a complex system to know that what they are purchasing is going to be supported by their own, in this case, cybersecurity engineering approach, and that of the regulator. So we will of course only be really looking at the medical device manufacturers themselves, but we expect medical device manufacturers will want to, in time, will want to bring their purchasing to bear around this set of SCADA systems and process control system elements. Dennis, does that answer your question?
I view the interconnected medical device security space from the different layers. I think on one layer we have the medical devices that are field inside managed networks and hospitals, who are the responsibility of an IT integration and clinical engineering, biomedical engineering department to make work. I think if you look at the parallels of SCADA systems with, you know, the electronic health records being equivalent to the enterprise management systems going in to optimize, there's very similar parallels. There's alarm systems, there's things that are protected, there's things that are more or less protected. I think how the integration thing may be different. We have a tendency toward, as people are going to be sent out of hospitals and monitored at home more quickly, there's going to be that transition to home care where the networks tend to be not very well managed. If they got a Wi-Fi hub that they've put in and left the Linksys password at admin, you know, that's going to be a different one. And then we have the whole area of wearable mobile iPhones as apps that become medical devices. And I don't know whether the 6443 stuff will be as relevant to I think that's where the analogy may stretch. But there's clearly a big issue within the hospital connected ones that that parallel works well for.
Okay, next question.
Hi, Marcel Simon from J&J. So in reading the guidance, the cybersecurity guidance, it talks about including security in the validation, and it defines validation as ensuring that requirements are met, which is great. Unfortunately, security validation, security testing, is more of a negative space discipline in that you have to make sure that the thing doesn't do, you know, anything else rather than meet something, right? And yeah, that's very hard, but at the same time, it is what it is. So what are your thoughts around either methodologies or, you know, since it's almost impossible to achieve that kind of negative space testing in its entirety, about what constitutes good enough in a validated, regulated world? What can you say about that?
So, the question is, sounds to me like, what are the security metrics, or what's good enough?
Certainly, I'm very interested in what FDA would have to say about that. But that really is a general question, because I approach it from a point of information security, but I'd love to hear it.
Well, gone are the days when a medical device was a black box placed on the market and, you know, fire and forget manufacturing process. These days, the medical devices are both redesigned and remanufactured throughout their entire life. The traditional quality system approach, which is that sort of stair-step approach, that's now all crushed together into one life cycle. So aspects of negative validation, which are really negative verification, can and must be conducted on an ongoing basis. And this is why our interest in fuzz testing at the moment. We would like to explore sustaining engineering in the cybersecurity space. We've explored sustaining engineering in the electronics and so forth, these other manufacturing arenas. But sustaining engineering in a cybersecurity sense, this is something that we have to get our head around. I think, frankly, a lot of manufacturers and users, that is to say the healthcare delivery organizations, also have to get their head around that idea. Patch management, fine, but that's a part of a constellation of approaches that needs to be brought to bear in order to keep these devices in an ongoing way safe and secure on networks that themselves mature.
It is a good question. I know, having read through the 62443, I think it's 4-1, which is really a overall security development, best practices security development process document. I think there is some stuff in there that addresses the difference between the positive requirements testing you do at one phase versus the classes testing you do to try to convince yourself that there isn't some egregious problem in the negative space. I think at one of Kevin's workshop, one of the gentlemen talked about a badnessometer, and that a lot of these,
that was Gary McGraw.
Yeah. And the basic concept is, when you throw these tests at it, whether it be fuzz tests, whether it be penetration tests, whether it be those kind of negative tests, if you pass, you really know nothing. All you know is that there's not something. So it's either I'm in really bad shape, or I don't know anything. And you just do enough different types of testing in that space that as long as none of them come up bad, you can't create, and that's why likelihood isn't something that you can do really well in these kinds of space from a traditional safety management of coming up with a likelihood band. All you can do is increase confidence to a level your organization says, well, I think the residual risk was within the acceptable range. And if you incorporate that with ability to monitor a deployed system so that you have the alerts happening that if something fell through the cracks, you have a means to respond, that's probably the best you can.
In fact, you're right, because, the negative space testing is good enough testing, right, where at some point you hit good enough, and then, of course, hopefully good enough evolves over time. So how we encode that in regulation, I think, is sort of the challenge here. And I don't have an answer. That's why I asked the question.
And I'll just chime in as a pseudo fourth panelist then. But you know, security testing, right, is just one element. And certainly if you're putting all your effort in security testing, you know, that wouldn't, I don't think anyone would think that'd be the right strategy, because quite a few things start with the architecture. Some of the lower level, for instance, what's in your specification for security? If you don't actually have meaningful requirements for security, it'd be sort of the testing wouldn't make any sense anyway. So there are other things you can do. So I have a more general question for the panel before we get back to questions. We have a number of students in the audience today, and they're all thinking about, oh, what research paper can I write? What kind of problem should I tackle? Oh, my advisor says I have to do something in the ivory tower. So from your different perspectives, what would you like to offer to some of the students or young researchers on interesting challenges that you think are beyond just deploying some existing solution, but actually are hard problems that need some innovation on the research front? If not, we can have a discussion, but what, Ken?
Well, I mean, the first one that'll hop to my mind would be about composability of systems when it comes to security properties, because these devices are being provided by different manufacturers. Is there, and in the end, that would ideally manifest itself in analytical tools that can be applied by IT staff at hospitals, or, you know, how do you evaluate whether or not a system is deployed, you know, that it meets particular security properties. But I think that when all the devices are being built by different manufacturers, I think it's a hard problem.
Yeah. But Lynette, would a security-oriented operating system for the medical domain actually be useful, or would it just be another thing that gets put on the shelf?
You threw off my answer.
Oh, okay.
No,
you can ignore my question.
I'm going to ignore Kevin's question because I have a soapbox in this area that Kevin has heard, and anyone who's been on a panel with me has heard several times. So from an operational standpoint, you know, our organization, we have to keep these devices on the network and running and providing patient services. There's a real cost impact, and you know, we can argue the merits of government, but we won't. But to private sector hospitals, when their devices get infected, there's a real cost that happens at that hospital to their operational budget. That device is taken offline, and they are charged most of the time by the manufacturer to have the device reimaged. So I'm talking like for a single device, it can be anywhere from $2,500 to $15,000 per device to have it reimaged. There's a significant cost factor to our healthcare industry and their operational budgets at these hospitals when these devices get infected. So what we really need to see is some really good research in the area of what's really happening with that device when it becomes infected. What position, what risk is the hospital really taking by continuing care with that device? What does that space look like? Because it's this huge unknown. And right now, we all have to drive to the patient safety side, which is to pull the device immediately out of service, cancel patient appointments, or fee out critical patients to other areas, all at a huge cost. And because we're living in a world of unknowns, we don't know what that malware does to that device. And I think, you know, that's an incredible space to start doing, because the devices are so diverse, you could spend your life doing research in that probably. But I really feel passionately about that, because if I had that answer, I could help my clinical engineers in the field make better decisions about what to do with those devices as we move forward. And the manufacturers would also have the information to help make better decisions about their own devices and how to keep them.
So that sounds like it would interleave well with the sub community on economics of information security. And that dovetails with risk management.
Mm-hmm. So perhaps I'm a little out of bounds here, but if there's a way for us to fix the econometric model of how we sustain small networks, small healthcare delivery networks, remote management, not just plug and play, but aspects of connectivity which are peer-to-peer knowledgeable. Contemplate for a moment home healthcare, which is something that we're all going to both experience and pay for. So by the time that many of the younger people who will be doing this research will be taking care of their parents, there'll be a lot of medical devices deployed around the average house. Those medical devices are going to be, and they'll vary from house to house, but they will all be either passing data to and from the electronic patient record systems and the sensors and the actuators in the in those houses. And we're not going to have a system administrator. We're not going to have an IT administrator, a network administrator in grandma's house. That's not going to happen. What we're going to have is a way for systems to compose themselves in criteria, in ways that whose criteria we want to advocate, like security, like trustworthiness, like, you know, optimized bandwidth, and so on and so forth. So I'm thinking that this would be, you know, the next Nobel Prize is how to get these disparate systems not just to interoperate over common protocols, not just to have similar signal pathways, but to find ways to compose safely enough that the minimum amount of external integration, perhaps even remote integration, could fix them. Perhaps even automatic external remote integration. So there you go.
All right, that sounds like it violates some theory of closure and
yes, it does.
Complexity
yeah.
theory.
That's why it's a Nobel Prize, Kevin. Yeah.
Okay. So we have just a couple more minutes. If you do, oh, is it a question?
Yeah, if we have time.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
So Dennis Fouquet again, University of Michigan. So Lynette, you showed some interesting numbers about malware infection in at the VA, 148 in 2012. As a researcher, I really love to see numbers like this. Where can I get more? Do other hospitals also report them? And if they don't, maybe is there a movement towards providing more data like that?
Wow, that's a big question. So as far as other, you know, so I've heard a couple of stories in this space, and maybe Brian and Ken can either confirm or deny them. In talking to other hospital organizations, so obviously as part of the Medical Device Innovation Safety and Security Consortium, constantly talking to other healthcare delivery organizations, VA is in a unique position of talking openly about our medical device infections because we're the government. And we're here to help, right? I mean, so the thing is that private hospitals don't have as much freedom to sort of talk about their medical device infections because you can imagine in the litigious society that we live in that would open them up for all kinds of lawsuits by patients thinking, oh, well, that may be why I now have, you know, whatever, because you
MRSA.
Know they had yeah
exactly
I got MRSA for my med, you know, I mean, so they don't, there's not really a form. And actually, Brian, I had this discussion two or so years ago, is how do we get that, how do we allow those healthcare delivery organizations, because it would really help Brian's conversation with his own leadership if he can get those reports in. So one of the things we're trying to do is through the consortium, which is largely provider-driven, is to gather that information and ask them to sort of voluntarily provide it to, like, our nonprofit third party that we can then anonymize it and then pass it through to Brian. And that's one thing that we're still pursuing and still trying to figure out how do we actually – it's actually far more complex than you would think, but – We want that data, and I think manufacturers want that data as well, because I think it helps their conversations as well with their own internal companies. So we don't have it figured out yet, but we're open to suggestions. Do you want to add to that?
That sounds like a potential research topic.
Yeah, exactly. I can make everything a research topic.
So it's very true. We have existing regulatory authority in FDA to look at failed medical devices. That's the unintentional failures due to bad designs or component failures, etc. If they hurt someone, there are requirements on the healthcare delivery organization and the manufacturer themselves to report those through to us in a system of organized post-market surveillance. And this is true not just of devices, but of drugs and biologics and everything else. But because now we're looking at the intentional aspect, we begin to wander into areas where there are existing law enforcement paradigms. And part of what we are confronting is our own sort of internal relationships with our own internal law enforcement. You may not know that FDA has its own sort of folks with badges in the Office of Criminal Investigation. It's strong liaison with FBI and the rest of that. And where we position our regulatory incentives and disincentives is important for them too. When we get to a point where we're looking at encouraging through incentives the reporting of these things so that we get some idea of what's failing this week, that may give us insights into common cause failure mode, and we may be able to go out with warnings, etc. The question is, we're the government, and unless there's a really darn good reason, almost everything goes public, which means the identity of the reporter may be made public. So this is a work in progress, as Lynette says. It's a work in progress at the user facility level, at the manufacturer level, and at the regulator level. How to incentivize reporting such that common cause failures can be readily identified in near real time.
All right. Well, we'll take a brief comment.
And my brief comment is to the management that doesn't believe this happens, this kind of data could be really effective in being able to fight back within a manufacturer to say, no, we actually have the data from it. So.
You had a quick comment, Lynette?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, we're out of time, and it's lunch, so I'd like to thank the panel. Let's thank Ken, Lynette, and Brian.